is FMR.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. My guest today is Matthew Willman, who is a documentary and fine art photographer who grew up during the last years of apartheid, and his boldness of character and independent creative expression was first realized as a professionally trained Kachete ballet dancer for 20 years. And then, interestingly, from a young age, he's never been afraid to express, to create, and to use the visual arts as an enabler. Willman continues to work with some of the world's foremost institutions in the field of visual communication, development, and the visual arts. And perhaps one of his greatest achievements was his significant contribution to the recording of the process of South Africa's democratic change. And in 2003, Matthew was commissioned to archive and document the life and times of Nelson Mandela for the Nelson Mandela Foundation, which by all accounts was a huge event in his life. Matthew, welcome to Fine Music Radio and to People of Note.
Rodney, it's fantastic to be here. Thank you.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say it's fantastic to be here. Yeah. But you travel so much, don't you? You seem to be all over the place. But here we have you in Cape Town.
Yeah, about 10 months every year I'm somewhere else doing my thing.
Internationally, that is.
Yeah, and nationally, internationally, SADC regions in Southern Africa. Depends where I go with my work.
Okay, so, for example, you must enjoy travel.
In principle, yes, but sometimes we know travel is hard.
God,
I'm not
going
to flower that up. That is very hard, yeah.
Before we get into all your exhibitions and this wonderful book we have here called Private Space, Pictures of Ballet Dancers in Black and White, which I want to come to, the process of interviewing and meeting Nelson Mandela clearly was a major event in your life. And you've got a book called Madiba with the most wonderful, I almost want to say intimate photographs of Mandela in there. How did you actually achieve that? Because you say it was an icy morning that you went into the office all nervous, clutching a camera. Who invited you, or how did you become a great friend of Madiba's?
So that's very brave of you to say a great friend of Madiba. Rodney, I grew up in KwaZulu-Natal, and as a young boy, I lost my mum when I was young, and then I went into boarding school. And one day, boardmaster said, right, we're all going to go watch the opening of some building in Durban called the RCC, the International Convention Center, and the joining Hilton Hotel. And, you know, begrudgingly, you're at school, you get in your school uniform and off you go on a Friday afternoon. And we were late, as the school I went to, and we stood at the back on the street. And yet, it was a bit of a I wasn't clear what happened, but one thing led to another. And I remember standing about 80 meters away from the podium, and this man got up, and it was Nelson Mandela. And I remember turning to my boardmaster saying, that's the man I'm going to journey to. I said, oh, I didn't say that word. I just said, I'm going to shake his hand one day. I remember, I'm only 14 years old, for heaven's sake. Mm-hmm. And he laughed at me. He says, yeah, you and the rest of the world.
And interesting, which is true.
But and anyway. It gave me purpose. It gave me direction. It gave me something to strive for, to live for, something beyond money, beyond dreams. And I committed the next 10 years of my life, or 9.5 years, to one day shake this hand of the man. But I realized that it was not that easy. I wrote 72 letters to the Nelson Mandela Foundation and the Office of the Presidency and Bishop Tutu and de Klerk and anyone who I thought could give me this inroad, this something. But no one did. No one willingly said, right, here's an open door. I had to do it myself. And I basically, when I was 16, I picked up a camera. And I realized then that I had a tool in my hand that would allow me to have access to places that ordinary citizens couldn't. Middle-class white boy from Pine Town in KwaZulu-Natal. It ain't going to come onto your lap. So I had to work for it. So I ended up packing my bags, and over a period of 18 months, I lived and worked on Robben Island. Backwards and forwards, I began to document the island. I then went to Nkununtekizweni Mvezu in the Eastern Cape, where Madiba's early childhood was. I got to know the communities down there. Then went to, you know, Palace of Justice, where the Rivonia trial happened. And then I began to meet influential people, Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
How old were you at this time?
Well, I had finished school. And
oh, you had just finished
school. Yeah, and I studied, did a degree in photography, advertising and documentary. And then I started a master's at UKZN. But all the while, whilst I was studying and doing this, this is what I was doing privately as like a private jobs kind of around. And I was basically a waiter, and I would waiter, and I'd take that money, and I'd put petrol in my little motorbike, and off I'd go, you know. But the unique and strange situation was I was meeting these incredible people, icons from our history, including P.W. Botha. I ended up living with him every year for 6 years in Wilderness. And he even, I don't know if the audience will appreciate this, but he left me his hat and his will. I got the money in the hood.
My goodness, Matthew.
Yeah, and I even drove his car in his funeral cavalcade. It's the most extraordinary story, and I kid you not, and I've written two autobiographies on these. I basically began this journey in life. Come hello, high water, I had nothing to lose, absolutely nothing to lose and everything to gain. I never made money my goal. Money is a resource I used to get me to the next stop. And so I think on my mum passing and then picking up a camera and my father allowing me to have the space and the freedom to just go, I did. And I haven't stopped. And it hasn't stopped 27 years later.
But Matthew, were you aware of the political situation in apartheid when you were very young, when you were 14?
That's a very important point, Rodney. I was naive. I grew up next to a convent, a Catholic convent next door in Pinetown. It was like the administrative head. And we used to like play in the garden and see these Oryx helicopters flying over. And I remember saying to a friend, oh, they're just more training missions. I mean, I'm only 12, 14. Mm. I was born 79, so 1990, I'm 11. And they weren't training missions. They were qualming the uprisings in Umlazi and, you know, Kwamashu and what was happening with the informants and the IFP and the ANC. I never knew any of that. And what I want to circumvent back to your question, how did I get to Mandela, is I believe that for me to have the honor, the privilege of just shaking this man's hand, I had to go on a journey first. So there I am, fast forward 9.5 years later, 10 years, reaching out, standing in his office at the Mandela Foundation in Johannesburg in Houghton, and I reached out my hand to meet this man. And one, no one teaches you protocol or what even call this man. So I remember, apart from almost genuflecting or curtsying, if I use that word, or bowing, I said, good morning, Mr. Mandela Madiba, sir. And because I didn't know what to call him. And I said, Mr. Mandela, it's taken me 9-10 years to meet you. Do you know what he said to me? I'll never forget this. Of all the things he said to me, he said, yeah? And why didn't you just phone me?
You must have
It was extraordinary.
Felt flabbergasted.
And what happened then was I did this incredible photo shoot with him. I was given 45 minutes with him. Incredible. Out the blue. It was based off my work on Robben Island. The Mandela Foundation had just brought itself into being after Mandela's retirement from presidency in 1999. He had founded this thing, but they had just built this which is now a museum, the Mandela Center of Memory in Central Street in Houghton. And the then director of the Center of Memory, who is an archivist, a wonderful man, who's the acting CEO of the Mandela Foundation now, Vern Harris, opened a door for me. And I think it was a testing. And so I came in, I did the shoot with him, I took some extraordinary pictures that became brand, I mean, they even say iconic images of Mandela, his 4664 hand, his Amandla fist, I mean, portraits. I spoke. I narrated my imagination of Mandela through my camera. 10 years is a long time to try and meet somebody.
It's
and
a very
failed
long
time. More times than none.
Were you nervous that morning you went on
my word? There are two emotions that I've never quite grasped. That is nerves and excitement.
And all at the same time.
That's what I'm saying. You don't know whether you need the loo or not. You're just like, what on earth? But, you know, once you're in that inner sanctum, that mm-hmm. fold, it's beautiful. And I had that privilege for many years.
Yeah. I'm about to ask you about his hands mm-hmm. and your obsession with them. But first mm-hmm. of all, I think it's time we took a piece of music.
I think so.
And this piece is called The River. Tell me about this and why you've chosen it.
You know, music is a part of me. I play.
Is it? I'm glad to hear you
yeah,
say that.
I'm a pianist. I've got a beautiful mini grand in my house. It's my release. You know, work. You know, my hobby that became my career is now you know the focus of all my energy. Mm-hmm. And now whenever I fly in, or the first thing I do is I put the bass down and I do two or three pieces on the piano, and then I'm like, right, I'm ready to go. So music has always played a huge role. So one of the first, most earliest films that I ever watched where I was conscious of the music was Ennio Morricone's The Mission. And, you know, I grew up within the Catholic Church, and I have a deep respect for those who have committed their lives within that, whether it's in the convent or priesthood. And just how this film was created with Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro in the 1980s, then this man comes along with this composition. This particular song we're going to play speaks deeply to the energy. We talk about energy. This is how I would translate energy into music, is this song. It's beautiful.
Music by Ennio Morricone from The Mission. And actually, it's quite refreshing to hear something different rather than Gabriel's oboe. That piece was called The River. It was the first choice of my guests on this week's edition of People of Note, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. Matthew Willman, a documentary and fine art photographer. And we're talking about Mandela in a lovely book of pictures that you were privileged enough to photograph. Some, as I said, are quite intimate. But as I said, you were definitely fascinated by his hands, weren't you?
That's right. You know, before I got to photograph him, and, you know, there were many greats have come before Mandela. I mean, Peter Magoban, Alf Kamalo, Jürgen Schadeberg, Debbie Yazbek. I mean, incredible photographers. And here I was, little old Matthew Willman, coming through at 23, 24 years old. I was always told to focus on his face and try to get that one iconic portrait. And, you know, when you live on Robben Island, when you stay on the island, you've gone back millions of times, you realize the humanity of those who survived the island, you know, the spirit that was there. And very quickly, I didn't even have to consciously think about it. So there I am sitting with Mandela for the first time. And yeah, I'd taken some beautiful portraits. And then I began to watch this man's hands and how he used his hands and communicated with his hands. And I was lucky that one cold morning in August in 2004, the light came through and the windows, and he was talking with these hands. And that's when I realized that actually the hands are telling a bigger story. And I was privileged enough to, because, you know, protocol doesn't allow you close to these people, maybe a meter and a half, whatever. But really, up close is rare. And Zelda, his former personal assistant, very kindly allowed me to just go over his shoulder and just take some hand pictures. And those have become icons of the
There's
time.
An incredible one where he's reading something and you're taking a photograph every
straight day. Mandela has these beautiful big puffy hands, and I had to actually spread his hands out and tell him to stop moving them right over his shoulder. He's breathing right next to my ear. And F8 at 1/25th of a second. Those who know photography, on all my work with Mandela was analog. I took that one shot and it became the brand image of Mandela's 46664 campaign. Mm-hmm. His last great commission on this earth. First was to liberate all the people, and others to demythologize and destigmatize HIV and AIDS.
Okay, one quick question, just going back a step or two. How did you get a job on Robben Island? What possessed you to do that?
The first two times I just bought a ticket and went, but then I got arrested.
What?
The island got upset, and then I had to be taken back to the Mandela Gateway, you know, where the island ferry lives, and they were like, who are you? Are you? What espionage is going on here? And I said, no, I'm just passionate. And they said, well, okay, after a while. And then they said, okay, well, finish your documentary, do it. And so they kind of gave me this pass to go and remember, this is the early days, 2001. It was that body of work that I was submitting to the Mandela Foundation, which got the notice of the foundation. And that's what we actually launched the Mandela Center of Memory in 2004 in September with that collection of Robben Island images.
Yeah, because the other thing is that sort of intrigues me is you became good friends, in fact, with Mr. Mandela.
No, not at all.
Oh, not?
No.
But he was very accommodating of you, wasn't he?
No, absolutely. But remember, he had a very, very, very trusted group of people around him, very small, very intimate, including his third wife, Gracia Michelle. I know the Mandela family very well. I think that obviously aided it. Zenani Mandela, posthumous now is Zinzi Madikizela Mandela Winnie. And then obviously Mandlisizwe Mandela. Each one on their own carries a certain part of Mandela, for good or for bad. Won't go there. But lovely family, and I just was so interested in their legacy as a family. And
did the family sort of welcome you as well?
Absolutely. Winnie Mandela was beautiful to me. She always gave me a big hug and a kiss. And Zenani Mandela, she's the oldest of the daughters of his marriage to Winnie. Very easy for her. She's the ambassador now to South Korea. Her and I keep in touch. We talk every now and again. Yeah, so I keep a low profile in terms of that because there's a lot of politics around.
Yes, of course. Goodness
but
me.
It's fine. I'm not there for the politics. I'm there because I like certain people.
And were you allowed to? Did they ever stop you from taking a photograph? I think
it was always very controlled.
Yeah, because there was one across two pages of a big room with everyone in it. Which is an unusual. I know you did all the close-up stuff for these hands and faces, but this big one of the office release.
Yeah, it was this post-presidential office of the Mandela Foundation, and I did this huge panoramic, and there was Winnie talking to Gracia in the corner, and then Madiba talking to Zinzi's daughter Zuleka. So Zinzi and Zuleka both passed now. Winnie's now passed. So the only two surviving people, no, one surviving person in that picture now is Gracia. Everyone else has passed. And I was actually told to delete that photograph. This particular person at the Mandela Foundation told me, they said, no, it's private space, you can't do this whole wide thing. And I hid the image. And after Madiba passed, I revealed it back to the foundation. And instead of being sort of ostracized and told that I'm going to be arrested, no, they embraced the image. And it's now, actually, when you go to the Mandela Foundation, just outside his office, there's a big panoramic of that photograph. Because people say, oh, you've changed the office since he died. No, they haven't. They've left it as is. So that image proves it.
And also, you've also had access, I read somewhere, to documents, very special documents to do with Robben Island, to do with the Rivonia trial, all sorts of
things. We were given access with a personal letter from Nelson Mandela to go into any state organ of state, particularly in the archives, and particularly pertaining to around the various court trials. And the one that comes to mind is the Rivonia trial. So I had the privilege of photographing all his documents, his charge sheet issued.
Yes, which you printed in the book.
So that book came about purely as a thank you, like a kind from the Mandela Foundation. I selected 100 of my works, and it's called We Called Him Madiba. How I just quickly came up with that title, because in the day of Gandhi, we called him the Mahatma.
Yes.
And the days of Mandela, we called them Madiba. So it was the same player. So, and it's just a wonderful, just a little archive. It's a keepsake book of not just pictures of Mandela, but his history, his Nobel Peace Prize,
the
Rivonia trial notes, the Freedom Charter.
The Freedom Charter, that's
which was a wonderful discovery in underneath Courtroom C.
Wasn't it written on the wall or something?
Yeah, which is now all passed because it was on lime, and now the humidity and everything, it's all fallen off.
Okay, but there's this picture.
But
now
I have this picture,
Good grief. Let's have another piece of music, Matthew, and I see Storms in Africa.
Yes.
Enya, what now? What are we in for?
No, I have the privilege of traveling across Africa, and not only my work in development for aid agencies, I get to go to landscapes in Africa are just incredible, particularly the Drakensberg. We all know that there was a beautiful film made by Alan Paton's book, Cry the Beloved Country, by Anand Singh and his brother Sanjeev Singh, where there's a scene where James Earl Jones is pleading to God in the mountains for his son who's going to be hung. And there's that song that gets played. And that, again, caught my imagination. So wherever I go, not only in South Africa, not in Africa, in the world, I put in my headphones this song, Storms in Africa, and it just encapsulates the energy I have around being African, identifying with Africa, and working in Africa across the borders.
That's Enya. The song was called Storms in Africa. Another choice of my guest, Matthew Willman, a documentary and fine art photographer. And another thing, Matthew, that I want to talk about now is ballet.
Mm.
Because we haven't mentioned yet, well, I think I mentioned at the beginning that you're a trained Kachete ballet dancer and you were for 20 years. And that's so different from photography and all that. So how did that slide into your life?
My mum was a big fan of ballet. and I'm a twin. And when I was 4 or 5 years old, my sister started to dance. And my twin sister, yeah. And my recollection is that I had to sit and wait. Mom wasn't going to fetch us 1-1-1, so I had to wait for her to do a ballet class. And they had a little nutcracker scene, and they needed a little toy soldier, so I became that. And then it was crazy. 6 years later, my twin sister gave up ballet, and I carried on another 20 years.
Wow.
No, ballet has given me the discipline. It has given me the confidence, presence of place. It has built so. It's given me so much more than just the act of dancing. Just from being trained, it's a remarkable world to be in, the ballet.
Yeah, because Matthew, I was going to say, it's a very, it's a world of great demands. It's a very demanding
taxing
profession,
on the body,
taxing on the body certainly, but
commitment,
also.
Yeah.
Commitment, discipline, as you said. Were you then professional for many years?
Yeah, so I trained. I did all the classes up to my teachers. So I did the advanced one. And in those days, there was just one advanced. There was one, those who know ballet, there's advanced one and two now. And then I was training to do my teachers. And that's when I got in with Mandela. And that all stopped.
Oh.
Because obviously new changes and stuff.
So then that brings me to your book, which is called Private Space. A hardcover coffee table book, which is completely fascinating, may I say. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's a little lucky, yeah.
All black and white, isn't it? Yeah. Or mostly black and white?
All in black and white, yeah.
And what struck me about that, so each page there's a dancer doing something, and they're doing it against a background, you call it private space, but they're all doing it against a very kind of industrial public background.
Yeah.
Sometimes even sort of broken down shops or bad window or the middle of a highway.
Yeah.
What was the purpose of doing that?
I had been asking for access to these ballet companies around the world for years, and they were all saying no. You know. So what I did was, after Mandela passed, I needed a kind of a sabbatical, and I wanted to always return back to the creative arts, and particularly ballet, because it's what I knew. And obviously, being too old to dance myself, I picked up a camera to start photographing. And through social media, I realized that I could actually create something beautiful. A dancer is a very private, personal space, the person of the dance. But that's why I've titled it Private Space. But yet all the dancers that I photographed are out of the studio, off the stage, in the streets of the world.
Completely out of their comfort zone.
So for 3 years, I traveled around the world, from Hong Kong to Cuba, from Vienna to England. But I was working with the ballet companies that had rejected me. So what I do through social media, I would make a post and I'd say, hi, I'm in Havana for 2 weeks. I'm looking for dancers from the Havana National Ballet, or I'd be in New York doing ABT, American Ballet Theater. And they would message me and they'll say, yeah, no, dance them, let's do it. So I got all their dancers without the permission of the ballet companies. And it was fun because they allowed to.
Yeah.
And
the dancers were quite willing.
Oh, my word, yes. No, there are 88 ballet dancers in that book, different ones.
Even when they realized what you were going to do, take them out into the middle of a street.
See, the beauty about knowing ballet is that I'm not a photographer that makes a dancer or model repeat something 20 times. That's disrespectful to them. This is their livelihoods, their ankle, their hips, their knees, everything. So they can't just jump on concrete and marble. They'll slip and break something. So I always made sure that the surfaces they were on, and I would never ever make them do the move more than twice. If I can't get it as a professional photographer, the mistake is mine, not theirs.
It's a bit of a challenge for you.
No, I loved it, and I managed to get the shots. Oh, a couple of times I didn't, but I was always very, very hyper aware of the condition of the dancer on that. But there is something extraordinary stepping out into let's say Central in Hong Kong or in Kowloon in China, and you bring this dancer, and it's extraordinary. The gathered crowds who would whistle and support, and you know, you go to London Hyde Park and you shoot in the middle of by backstage, no one blinks an eyelid. New York as well, my word, we had people walking into us with their cups of coffee from Starbucks, you know. They don't care. But when you go to countries that are less familiar with ballet, it's like you brought the circus to town.
The other thing that struck me, and now maybe I missed something, is very often when there are crowds around, like Central Station in New York, for example.
Yeah, yeah, Grand Central.
Grand Central. It looked as though they just went on with their business.
Yeah,
they didn't
crowd
around and stare.
No.
And a lovely picture on a tube train, I think.
Yeah, a Vajeshin. He was a Polish dancer at the Royal Ballet, so we're underground.
And no one was really looking at him.
If you're not in people's way, they're not going to really bother.
Yeah.
Remember, there's minstrels and there's people doing, street side busking. there's so much of it, so you're just another blur, you know, getting to work and back. But every now and again, you'll get viewers and people.
Yes, and top of buildings.
Never had one bad experience.
Really,
never,
in all that?
All that. No one tried to threaten us. No, I mean, in the middle of Warwick Triangle, in the middle of Durban, I mean, it was extraordinary. It's a beautiful male ballet dancer. It's an ode to Mother Africa. There was a big mural on the wall, which we danced to. It's in the book as well. People were just applauding and... You know, oh, I can't point my toes.
Shame, man.
Yeah, no,
but are these books that we're talking about available to the public?
Through my website, yeah.
Oh, through your
website. So they're all self-published. So I do a lot of public speaking around the world, and it works for me to self-publish and then just sell them through my website and that. But anyone who's interested in this particular book, there's only like 60 copies left. I printed 2,000.
It's been
incredible how ballet has spoken a language around the world. And I'm not going to do a reprint because I'm busy working on my second book on ballet. So, yeah.
Let's do your website twice. Let's do it now and again at the end of the program. Where do people write to?
I have two wonderful websites. The first is more digital work, which allows me to just shoot as many images as I can. It's matthewwillman.co.za, www. And then I'm a sort of master photographer in analog photography. So I have wonderful 1950s, 60s cameras, which I hand print myself in my darkroom back home in KZN. And I have a website for that called thewillmancollection.com.
That I like that, thewillmancollection.com.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about this digital and analog thing. Mm. But before that, another piece of music. And I see we're in the opera here.
Yes.
Marriage of Figaro now. I'm a bit surprised. Why? What have you chosen and why?
Not that I'm a connoisseur on all this, but there's an incredible film called The Shawshank Redemption with Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman. That's my favorite film of all time. And I just love the story of these two men who come from vastly different backgrounds who find themselves in the deplorable situation of a prison cell in the 1920s or 30s in America and how one escapes. And again, music comes to the fore. And the only way Morgan Freeman can express his feeling about liberating himself in the confines of a prison is to play music. And Tim Robbins, who's the guy who escaped, breaks through the system and he locks the door and he puts on over the intercom system of the prison this incredible aria. And anyone who watches the film will see it. These institutionalized men who had been forgotten by the world, stopped whatever they were doing, and they heard these beautiful birds singing, you know. Again, it's encaptured imagination. And for that film, I've traveled to where they filmed it, in Ohio, in the state of Ohio in America, and it's very real. These prisons in America are very real. So this is why this song is part of my little collection today. Oh,
Mozart's music here on Fine Music Radio on People of Note. The Marriage of Figaro, a duet from that, and it was the choice of Matthew Willman, my guest, who is a photographer, fine art photographer, author, and professional speaker, and who seems to me to have been all over the world. Just looking at a list of your selection of galleries and exhibitions, the United States in Ohio, Arkansas, London, Belgium, Australia, Wales, Germany, Mexico, even Houghton, South Africa, and Norway. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, and it does appear on your biography here, you founded a non-profit foundation trust to support your various endeavors with a focus on enabling young South Africans in their quest for education and development within the field of visual and commercial arts. Mm. How are you going about that?
We'll never own a building and we'll never have own a car, but what we will do is we create a back end to open doors for these young dancers, mainly photographers and dancers, because that's where my passions lie, and particularly male ballet dancers. We have incredible talent in this country, and we've been very successful, and our goal is to get them overseas, you know, through whether it's auditions, applications, forms, or whatever. So we have a dancer in the Vaganova in Russia, Ben Glennie, which I've mentored. To get there, the Elmhurst in Birmingham, ABT in America, we've got...
all young South Africans.
South Africans, yeah. Mixed color, races, whatever, everyone. Yeah. It's about ability. And just get them off our shores, because it's very difficult to forge a career in South Africa, in ballet in South Africa today, the challenges. So we try to get them overseas. And then obviously photography. So we have students passing through the Stellenbosch Academy of Photography, and then I have a mentorship program, which students talk to me on a regular basis. It's all photography based, you know. I try and align their thoughts and their minds to open up the idea that, you know, you're a very small fish in a very big pond. So how do you gain traction? How do you do that? So this arts trust founded on the words Mandela gave me. I sat with Mandela the one day and I said to him, "You're the great Mkulu, the great Mandela. What can I do to make a difference?" And he said to me, "If you want to be relevant, you must serve." And those are beautiful words. It's actually written on the back of my Mandela book. If you want to be relevant, you must serve. And I've used my talents and my abilities to pay it forward. And this is how I do it, just through encouragement. Our youth need... what I fight and rile against every day is apathy and indifference. That is a poison in our society, particularly in this instant gratification, young adults that we're bringing up, with social media and stuff. They've become indifferent to what's going on in the world.
How do you choose people to mentor?
Nine times out of ten, they come to me.
Oh, they come to you, okay.
No, if I see an opportunity, like Leroy Mokgale, who won the Prix de Lausanne, you know, we supported him. That was incredible. There's Cowley, and then we've got dancers, Benny, Glennie. It's just been, you know, they don't come out of the blue. You know, I'm not involved, but I'm very aware of the world of ballet in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of have an ear on the ground of who's doing what and where, and then you kind of step in and you see where you can help.
Yeah. Matthew, what I said just before that piece of music was, I was surprised when you said you work mostly in the analog medium. Why not digital? Or did you have digital then change back? Well, just tell me a little bit about that.
So I studied in analog, but there was no such thing as digital in those days, in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then, you know, I'm a commercial photographer. So when digital came about, everyone made that leap into digital because it was cheaper for clients and whatnot. And the access to images was so much quicker. So, yeah, I moved into that. But now, since I'm in a different stage in my life and I do more private work, I've gone back to analog, which is my great love. You know, for me, 50% is taking the picture and 50% is printing it.
Hence your darkroom in your home.
Yeah, that's right. And I spent hours, my poor eyes, in this darkroom in this red light. But the magic that you bring. I don't do editions. I'm not a photographer that does 20 million editions. If I take a negative and I put it in the enlarger and I create an A2 60 by 40 image or whatever it is, I'll only print it once. There's one image. Yeah, it's beautiful.
And working in black and white?
Always in black and white, yeah.
It works incredibly well with the dancers, certainly, the ballet dancers that you did. Yeah. It's timeless.
Timeless, that's what I'm after. You're holding a memory. My whole life, because of tragedy in early life, and I had to go to boarding school as a ballet dancer, you can imagine that trials there.
Yes.
It wasn't that bad, but still, it's challenging with a whole bunch of rugby players and everything, and in South Africa in the 90s. My whole life has been around this Welsh word, hurriath. I don't know if you've heard that word.
No, I haven't.
It's a beautiful word the Welsh use to recording of memory. It's a longing for a place you can never return to. And they've managed to encapsulate it in this word. I think I've, you know, really challenged the meaning of it, but that really is. It's about recording a memory. And I'm a memory lover. I'm a storyteller, both verbally and through my photography. And that's what I've done. I've just recorded memory. I think that's why I lasted so long at the Mandela Foundation, is because I understood what it was to record memory, you know, not just record history, but to capture images that speak long after. I remember saying to the foundation, you need images that will speak Mandela's voice after he's gone. Right now you've got historic images. Historic is great. Walking after freedom on the 11th of February 1990, becoming president on the 10th of May 1994, all these things. But you need memory images. And a lot of my clients employ me or commission me for that very essence, is memory.
You've got all these clients that commission you to do various projects. Do they get you to do all sorts of different projects, or does it tend to be more to do with the world of arts?
I think it's an amalgamation of a lot of things. Clients, you know, they want to bleed blood from a stone. want everything.
Sure.
And now with digital age, they want you to be a videographer too. I can't do that. I don't do that.
I was going to ask you if you do any film.
No. I am a stills photographer. Stills photographer. So they know my brand. They know what I offer and I give. And I'm very blessed that they understand that this is what I'm going to offer for their advertorial campaigns or their marketing campaigns or whatever. And that's what I give them.
Okay. Yeah. And it sounds like you kept busy as well, by the way.
So I'd say 70% of my time is my own work I'm working on. And then for the financial side, until the works like these exhibitions I've got going, I'm sharing with the world my creations. And they're vast, different type of works.
And it's important to share with the world your memories, don't you think? It's not all that private.
Well, absolutely, and I made that mistake. I did a shoot with the President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, and his wife then, or Carla Bruni. I had a conversation with her, and I said to her, she said to me, do you believe you should speak with your work, your artwork? And I said, well, of course, I'm from Africa. We've got issues. We must talk about them, you know, food security, primary health care, you know, everything, AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis. And she says, no. She just went, no, an artist must never speak. Your work must speak. And I've never forgotten those words. You know, and I think she was right, you know. So I try, when I do an exhibition, I allow the work to speak more. But in my public speaking, obviously, I speak with my images and I tell the stories that hopefully people will be able to get a bigger insight into what it is to live with AIDS, what it is to be homeless or a transgender or albino running away from your community because you're going to be hacked up and,
gosh. Yeah. Wise words there, Matthew. But just now, because we're reaching the end of the program, may I ask you what you're working on at the moment? Are you having a bit of a break? Are you rushing around?
No, thank you. I'm in Cape Town now for a couple of days. I've got an exhibition at the Spear Arts Trust in Commercial Street in Cape Town in Union House. It's a collection of eight of my prominent works on Nelson Mandela, including the Freedom Charter, the Mandela Fist, 46664 Hand, etc., and there's Rivonia Trial Notes. And then I've got another exhibition at the Hamilton Gallery in the Old Biscuit Mill. And that's, I've been working privately over the last couple of years on black nude figures, shot in a very Herb Ritz type of way, but the compositions are very African. So that launched actually this month. So I've got those two exhibitions running through till July.
Will that come out in book form, the black nudes?
Not right now. It's just because it's an ongoing project. So once I think I've got like 60 works together, then I'll create a book. But right now it's just an exhibition of work. And then I leave the whole of June. I am in Zambia. I'm curating artists in residence in Livingstone, Victoria Falls,
good
in Zambia
for
my first exhibition in Africa. Usually all the work goes overseas, but
yes.
I'm bringing a collection of 60 works to Livingstone, Victoria Falls. I've been doing a documentary on Victoria Falls for the last 4 years, just a private analog film, you know. So that's what I'm working on, and then I'll be back in Cape Town in July. The roadshow carries on.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you're a happy chappy by all accounts. You look very, very happy with these amazing achievements you've had so far.
Well, I certainly don't think about them all the time.
let's give your website address again for people who might want to find out more about these books.
The first one is www.matthewwillman.co.za. And then the other one, the analog collection, is thewilmancollection.com.
Okay. Now we come to your last piece, which is in fact from the world of ballet, that lovely pas de deux from the Nutcracker.
Yes.
So yes. I want to ask you maybe the obvious question, why have you chosen this particular extract?
You know, I first performed the Nutcracker in 1990. I was the Nutcracker doll at NAPAC, Natal Performing Arts Council, and the beautiful theater there. And I performed that role for 4 years. And this pas de deux, it's just the climax of Tchaikovsky's creations with this ballet. It encapsulates everything I see in pas de deux between, you know, sort of the prince male and this beauty of the female, you know, doing the pas de deux. For me, it's probably one of the most well-known of Tchaikovsky's pieces, but as dramatic as you can get. And I just thought it was fitting to include it in our little
Well, I'm
session.
Glad you did. And Matthew, it's been great speaking to you, and thank you for sharing so much. And we're looking forward to seeing more of your work. You've given us the website, so all the best. All strength to your arm.
All the best to you, Rodney. Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
FMR.